Thank you, all three of you, for those spectacularly interesting presentations. Thank you also for stopping on time so we have some time for you all to discuss amongst yourselves. And I'd like to, I have many questions to ask the three of you, but I'd like to start by asking you, and this is a conversation, so please all of you ask questions of each other if you'd like to. I'd like to ask, begin by asking Avery and Ramsey to reflect on Slavenka's presentation. And the way into this is to, because this is a conference about the nation state, to think about the way in which the nation state arose very much in parallel with significant imaginations of internationalism. Nationalism was always allied with internationalism. And for people looking back from 1914, they would look back on at least 50 years of what might be called civilization, of the escalation of an international framework designed to protect people from for instance, the negative effects of war. There was the foundation of the Red Cross, there was the Geneva Convention, there were all kinds of international instruments put into place to ensure that war was limited, that war was not declared unless it was absolutely necessary, and the high point of this, of course, is the foundation of the League of Nations. What do you make, Ramsey and Avery, of the situation that Slavenka brings to our notice, which is one in which international tribunals really do not have the capacity to deal with these kinds of issues, and these things are thrown back into national space where clearly war criminals will not be treated as such?
Well, actually, I think that maybe this is too simple a response, but in some ways we had two very similar main points and conclusions, because Slavenka was saying nationalism prevents justice. It's just, it's not happening. And the institutions of the state, whether they be at the super level, the internationals, I mean, the international is a set of nation states in that sense. And in a way, both Ramsey and I were saying the police state prevents any kind of safety, much less justice. And so we might need to pick up where Ramsey ended, which is our safety is with us. Mm. I mean, this is, I think, a more challenging proposition to think about, you know, in the case of the realms of safety and policing and so on that you and I were sort of talking somewhat similarly, somewhat differently about. There has been an interesting set of activist efforts, particularly around urban policing, to teach people how to avoid calling the police when there is a problem we would normally call the police for, including in the United States not calling 911, which is the emergency number you call if you need an ambulance and you've been hurt, because they send the police also. And so there's all this attempt that came really out of the feminist anti-violence movement in communities of color, where the problem was, how do you deal with the safety problem without calling the police and therefore embroiling the community already with a problematic state agency? And so for me, it'd be interesting to see what happens if we start where Ramsey ended, or another way to put it is, would it be possible to imagine justice without the state, either an individual nation state or even an international tribunal or a court in that sense? Could there be justice without that? What would that entail? Is that possible?
Or would it be better to simply try to forget, right? Which was the question that yeah. Slavenka raised, yeah. which you know, I thought, which I found very, very thought-provoking, because obviously that's sort of the main fork in the road for many, you know, post-conflict societies or, you know, post-traumatized societies. And the reason I found it intriguing is, like, even if you sort of take a very narrow focus on the things that you and I were talking about, what possible redress could there be for some of these things that were done to people, for what was done to entire societies, right, for what continues to happen today in places like Iraq or Syria? You know, what possible justice might arise? It is hard to fathom given, you know, the depth and breadth of the harm that's been done. And certainly when you zero in on the point at which U.S. discourse finds itself, where we're so far from any recognition of responsibility, the U.S. society as a whole has not taken ownership for what it's done in the name of its own security. I think we're at least a generation or two, and certainly if precedent is anything to go by, it took a full generation before the U.S. tried to grapple with Japanese incarceration in World War II. And even then, the way that it grappled with it in the end was sort of, you know, tepid and imperfect and frustrating, dissatisfying. And so I think that the question that Slavenka raised to my mind is a question that's worth exploring because, but of course, it's a question that has to be explored by the communities that paid the price.
Yeah, I mean, another way to say this might be that you can't have justice unless the conditions that produce the violence, the crime, the misery, the so on, are eliminated.
Yeah.
And they've not been in any of these situations. So to me, I mean, this is what justice requires, a certain level of reconstruction in that sense. It requires that kind of elimination, like I said, of the conditions that produce it in the first place. I mean, this is an interesting, if you think about the South African Truth and Reconciliation process, where there was two sort of interesting elements to it, at least for here. One is that the South African Commission identified four different kinds of truths. So there wasn't one truth, there were four different kinds. Forensic truth, subjective truth, social truth, and Ubuntu. And Ubuntu is in some ways a kind of, you could say, community spiritual element of it. And all the reports at the end of this elaborate process understood that even reconciliation would not produce social justice, that they had no mandate to do that. And so that relationship between truth and justice required something else, which the commission itself could not produce by itself.
And it's important to have that language, right, that distinction between, because you're correct, like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process does not yield social justice. That's not what it's intended to produce. It is intended to produce closure. It is intended to produce a form of forgetfulness and advancement past these historical traumas.
Well, what do you...
Yeah, if I can say something. I think we are kind of speaking from... probably from different standpoints. First of all, I'm no expert on law or anything for that matter. But I think it's different when you speak about more in principle about the war that happens somewhere else and your country is part of it, like America, or if the war happens very nearby. What the problem, one of the problem of justice and truth in this country, in these countries involved in war, in former Yugoslavia, is that witnesses do not want to speak. People are afraid to witness. Why? Because they live in the same little place of, I don't know, 20,000 people, and they see their perpetrators every day on the street, you know. So if you know what will happen if you speak up against this person. So this have even been noticed by independent people who are, you know, organizations watching it and so on. So it is, I think, very, why this come to mind, this, okay, let's forget it, because you see that we are stuck. We can't really go further than that. There are people who want closure, as you said, this is a very good word, but there are people who are afraid to witness about it. And it's very difficult to reach the truth, you know, or truth, as you already said. Now, one word about Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was formed in Bosnia. There is such a commission, but it didn't achieve, I don't know, nothing. Why? Is it different culture? I'm not sure. Is it because the society is much smaller? I'm not sure. But I know that it didn't come to any end. And we, when we are speaking about these things, I think we should take into consideration something that we think we are, but we are not, that these countries all came out of a communist state. These authoritarian countries, they have no faith in juridical system. They have no, they have different social conscience, let's say, and in, they sometimes fall into this, what should I say, tribal situations where you believe somebody from your tribe, but you don't trust someone from the other tribe. So I think this model of course, they know it. I mean, model of Truth and Reconciliation Commission from South Africa absolutely does not work there. Somebody says, okay, if I would know who had killed my child, I would kill that person immediately. And it's a different, different culture, maybe. So therefore, it comes to your mind, what about if we try to... I don't know how successful Spanish model it is. I think that from time to time they have problems too, because they are sweeping truth under the carpet. But here we are all the time in a circle, whereupon the individual politicians are using that to inflame the situation in terms of nationalism for their own means. And actually, it looks as if nobody, but only relatives of victims want to know something. Everybody else would rather forget. Mm.
But over all of history, one of the principal things that people have sought is justice. And one of the reasons that any political community has ever been formed is because somebody has a better offer of justice than somebody else. And so if in this situation where there is no body or individual that can supply justice, where does one look?
Nowhere. There are still courts, there are still cases processed very unwillingly, very with great difficulties. Nobody's very happy about that. But on the other hand, nobody in that part of the world is, I will say something now which will sound strange to you, is used to the concept of truth. Because from 1945 on, we never had truth. When I went to school, I didn't learn true facts about the Second World War. I learned official history, and official history is history produced by the government, which at that moment was communist government. So you learn interpretation. You learn about offensives that Tito led and Tito won. You do not learn about the other side. You do not learn how many people were killed by these anti-fascist Tito communist forces. You do not learn, you only learn exaggerated numbers. For example, the number that we learned at school that were killed in, because Croatia during the war was a fascist puppet state between 41 and 45. And they had a concentration camp called Jasenovac. We at school learned that it was 700,000 people killed in that camp, which is physically impossible. It was absolutely impossible. After many years, and as of late, the number upon which everybody agrees is between 60 and 70,000 people. So 10 times less. Why did we learn that number? It was not only to, so to say, to make this government, fascist puppet government, even worse. No, it was for the reason of reparations, because Tito's government wants more money for, and therefore was exaggerating in terms of numbers. As kids, we never learned another thing, and this is that Tito's army committed terrible crime at the end of the war. When the war was officially finished, there were troops withdrawn towards Slovenia and Austria, and there in the place called Bleiburg, it was some number of probably 50, 60, it's not really, this is not the number that everybody agrees about, killed not only army, withdrawing, but also civilians with them. There are mass graves, and so one of the things that is very problematic still today. So if you are not grown up with, and if you in school do not learn the concept of truth, much less of justice, then it's even more to deal with this new war and the new truth and the new justice.
I think one of the things I keep saying in every platform I'm on in this conference is the way in which the modern West, by seeking to civilize and defeat the rest of the world, actually becomes that thing it's trying to defeat. So the world you're describing, in which truth is something that no one has ever encountered, is something that the former Soviet bloc might be teaching America today. I use that to transition to something you were saying yesterday, Ramzi, which is that this war, the Yugoslav war, inaugurates a moment or an ethos of US military intervention, which we have become more and more familiar with over the years. It did not begin in the Middle East necessarily. It began here. I suppose my question is, to paraphrase Voltaire, if 9/11 did not exist, would we have had to invent it? That is to say, what is the other work that is being done by this whole post 9/11 world? What has been achieved for US power by this new regime?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, before I talk about that, I didn't want to say, I mean, you know, what Slavenko was saying, to my mind, I feel like no history is honest, right? So it isn't just the unique particular situation of education in the former Soviet bloc countries that suffers from, you know, what Slavenko is describing. I think all of the histories, I mean, I myself was educated in some pretty dramatically different educational systems, Arabic language or French language or English language, and they all suffer from their own historical biases and they all reflect political agendas that are hidden in more or less sophisticated ways. And I think it's important to go through that work of deconstruction that Slavenko was discussing across settings, right? Regardless of whether it's
just,
you know,
a quick intervention, Ramzi.
Sure.
And this is what you are saying. It's, I completely agree with you. But you could say that in undemocratic country, you could not say that.
No, I understand. I mean, I grew up in undemocratic.
I grew up in undemocratic countries
where saying that would land
difference.
You in prison.
I fully
understand that, or worse. But at the same time, I don't want to glorify the histories that exist in, you know, so-called democratic countries, because I think they are also deeply problematic and perform political work and also perform significant erasures of past injustice. And I could talk about the American situation, which, you know, I know intimately, and the ways in which histories and narratives, you know, erase some fundamental facts of American history, right? We could also talk about Europe and the fact that most of European wealth is equally based on slavery, just like, you know, American wealth. But to move on to your question, I think that was a key moment. You know, I talked about the first Gulf War in my earlier lecture, because that was sort of the first expression post-Cold War of U.S. interventionism, but that was done under the aegis of the United Nations to some extent. But when you look at what happened in the Balkans, and also when you look at what happened in Somalia, those are, you know, unilateral expressions of U.S. Force projection overseas, right? And we've seen that repeat itself, first with the United States, 2003 in Iraq, Afghanistan earlier, since then by other countries. And you're also right, Rana, that had there not been this tremendous window of opportunity in 9/11 for the United States to project its might and assert its dominance, then certainly, you know, U.S. policymakers would have seized another opportunity. Those opportunities may have been smaller, and they may have made for more gradual gains, more gradual sort of projections of American unilateral power. 9/11 gave the United States an opportunity to do that in huge strides with Afghanistan and Iraq. But I think that, again, the United States, no different from any world power that suddenly finds itself in a dominant position, is going to tend to take advantage of that to the maximum extent possible. Other historical world powers have done the same, and that's what we saw with 9/11. It was sort of this, you know, unhoped for window of opportunity that, you know, allowed actors in the U.S. government who were planning to go into Iraq as early, to go back into Iraq as early as the mid-90s, to finally be able to push that agenda through.
I'm just going to ask, I'm going to come to you because I want to clarify this question slightly. I think the point is not simply that a superpower that can expand its reach will do so. No. It's that there is some kind of transformation of the nature of power that's going on in that process. And one of the things that both your work, all of your work refers to or shows is the way in which this is both an external and an internal process. So if you look at the period from 1979 onwards, you see the gradual rolling back of the processes of the previous few decades to expand suffrage, expand rights, and all that kind of stuff, which starts to be reversed in the 80s. And it looks like there is a complete re-engineering that reaches certain kinds of limits, which require a radical intervention for the re-engineering to continue. So my question is also about what is the change in the nature of power that is happening at this point, which 9/11 is rhetorically useful for.
Okay, well, I mean, this requires a certain drilling down into American history that people may or may not be particularly interested in, and I would begin to quibble with some of the historicization sort of frameworks that are being set out here. I mean, so to make one sort of general point, which is the United States, like the great European empires, became wealthy through war. I mean, imperialism is a form of warfare. And so it's important not to separate those things. It looks different to us today, but that's what it was. And so the period of time when America grows economically is a period in which a part of the world we haven't talked about at all, but which is the central southern Latin America, what you would call it, is really a militarized playground for the United States. And it is essentially using something called gunboat diplomacy to build wealth that it understands to be its regional prerogative. And it's really, so just to say, there is a larger pattern here in which the United States, like other empires, grows wealthy by using its military power to take what it wants.
Right. And the Philippines, okay. And Guam, and Hawaii.
And the Spanish-American War. Yeah, we can. That's what I'm saying. We can do the history in a different kind of way. In terms of to me, what's crucial for understanding, to a little bit tackling the question you first started with, which was if the bombing of the Twin Towers hadn't happened, would they have had to invent it? And that there, I think that it's important to go back not so much to 1979, but maybe closer to 1973, in which the United States is suffering a tremendous economic crisis, like the world at large, and that whole post-war affluence that builds, in effect, not just a very powerful country in the post-war period, but the wealthiest country, is collapsing. It's in crisis. That wealth is produced through a military-industrial economy. This is how the United States gets very wealthy. And so, of course, it becomes completely addicted, dependent on some kind of war. And in fact, that's part of the function of the Cold War, is to build up that military-industrial complex in a moment in which everyone is expecting there would be peace. There was a presumption that there would be demilitarization after the Second World War, after there had been at every other war, and that never happened. And so the greatest moment of power and wealth that is in the living memory of every leader that we've had so far in the United States is this period of time. By 1973, it's in crisis. And so waves of deindustrialization, the essential outsourcing and destruction of the industrial core and infrastructure produces, I think, part of what the mass prison boom that's already starting in the early 70s. I mean, this is all the great urban rebellions in the United States in the 60s and the 70s are already about that. And so by the time we get to 2001, in a way, the US economy requires perpetuation as a war economy. And I mean, I think that we can't think about this without thinking about that. And so, I mean, part of the hysteria of it, in my view, is connected to the fact that it is a predatory, parasitical economy that's under tremendous debt. I mean, the United States is mostly owned by foreign money right now. It's incredible levels of debt. The highest levels of income inequality and income stratification in the world. We have the highest levels of inequality. It's a country in great crisis. And so both in 2001 and then again the ratcheting of it up now, I think is very much connected to that and connected to the only thing the United States is still doing at an industrial scale, and that is security, war, surveillance, technology, policing. It's part of the reason why I was sort of saying we need to talk about police power more generally in a police state. And, you know, all the issues that Ramzi was first talking about, they're all policing issues of one sort or another. So,
yeah, no, I completely agree that, you know, the United States for a very long time treated the Western Hemisphere as its own, you know, playground. Those continuities obviously predate 9/11, and they go back to the founding. I mean, even sort of looking internally, what we consider to be the inside of the United States today, the acquisition of territories like Texas and California, and then Hawaii and Guam, and then Philippines, and obviously Central America, the Caribbean, South America. I think, you know, those were the expressions, the projections of power within the Western Hemisphere prior to 9/11. And then what we see in the 90s is sort of a more bold assertion of the same sort of unilateralism that was familiar to anyone who studied U.S. history up until that point, in the Balkans, in East Africa, in 1993. And that sets the stage for what we've been seeing on a larger scale and in a deeper way in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now in Syria and Yemen, directly or indirectly.
I don't want to defend the United States. I don't want to be here the one who is defending it. But I have to say that if it wasn't for the United States, maybe the war in the Balkans would be going on still. It's really, sorry to say, it was the America who actually ended up the war in Bosnia and forced the Milosevic, Izetbegovic, and Tudjman to sign the Dayton Agreement. We are not discussing how this agreement, is it good, bad, what should be done. But, I mean, Europe did absolutely nothing. They didn't even understand that there is a war going on. They refused to see that there is a war going on there. So, actually, America broke the peace. Number two, it seems to me that there is no without reason that in Pristina, Kosovars erected the golden statue of Bill Clinton, golden statue. It, I mean, it's very kitschy, of course, but I mean, in some way, there was some kind, let's say, a positive involvement. Saying all that, I'm also saying that today, on the 24th of March, 1999, there was a bombardment of NATO. Of Serbia, 1999, because of this huge Kosovo exodus, you know, and so it's so-called humanitarian intervention in 1999, 18 days to today. So I'm not an advocate, but I'm saying just that this also should be perhaps taken into account, that Europe in our own, you know, in our own surrounding, it did not really react for a very, very long time at all.
Though the expansion of US power is both these things, or all these things, and clearly these things don't necessarily contradict each other. It's not that we have to come to a verdict on whether the US is a good or bad force. It is an enormously complex and dominating force in the world, which produces all kinds of effects. I'd like to, we have just a few minutes, and I'd like to really take up the issue of Islam in all this. It is clear that for reasons that might have nothing to do with terrorism or whatever, that states all over the world, small and large states, have given up a lot of their idealistic promise and exchanged it for a security promise. They have essentially become containers of human beings and capital in various ways, and they've promised property rights, security, surveillance, and all these kinds of things. That's the promise they make to their populations, and it's the promise they make to capital. And in that, many excuses could be used for that. Many ideologies could have been produced to signal that kind of shift. But terrorism has been the most widely used. And it's usually, it's highly identified with Islam. This produces a set of international relations, and it also produces a set of internal relations and a new status for Islam within a lot of countries. What is the, how would you historicize this, and what does it have to do with the loss of the big enemy, which was the Soviet bloc in the West after 1989? All of you. It affects all of you.
What's the start?
Sorry.
Ramzi, why don't you take it up? Because Avery's just spoken.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the relationship between between Islam and or countries or Muslim populations, Muslim majority countries, however you want to put it, the so-called West, because is a long and complex and fluid relationship that began long before the current historical moment and its obsessive focus on what is called by some radical Islam or Islamic terrorism, if you're quoting Trump, and that history bleeds into the current moment. It drives it in some ways, but I think the ideology, the language that's being resurrected from past engagements, is being put to use towards new different ends. So to be more specific, there's no dearth of literature and analysis detailing the different forms of contact between various Islamic civilizations and various other civilizations, not just in Europe, if you're looking at Andalusia or the region that Slavenko's from or other parts of Europe, but also in Africa, also in Southeast Asia, also in present-day Southern Asia. The Western analysis of that relationship, the way literature has spoken of Islamic tradition and Islamic actors from Dante on to more contemporary literary and intellectual figures, that's been studied exhaustively. So there's a reservoir of tropes and of ideas and a logic that can be deployed in service of contemporary political aims. So today, I think where the post 9/11 moment is different is that there was an opening, there was an opportunity for an unprecedented kind of U.S. involvement in a region of geostrategic importance and a region of vital economic importance to the United States' economic might and to its military might. And so once that space opened up for the U.S. to have a larger footprint, an uncontested footprint in places like Iraq, in places like Afghanistan, once it was able to do that more directly, perhaps, than it could in the past, then, of course, I think there's an entire academic and intellectual apparatus that mobilizes to justify that use of force. And that academic and intellectual apparatus is naturally going to draw on this deep historical reservoir of really anti-Muslim animus.
We're totally out of time. Last comments?
I think I would just say this, that the terrorism charge is very, very old. I mean, it is the basic structure of counterinsurgency, you know, whether it's Jacobins or Northern Scottish Highlanders or Maumau tribes in Kenya or the ANC or the PLO or
all across
the
empire.
Black Panthers or whatever. So it's a completely fungible format. And the production of Islam as an insurgency is ironically, of course, something that the regimes most dedicated to wiping it out as a form of terror have been most implicated in producing. And that seems to me to make the situation more distinct than it was the case when you could, you know, accuse the ANC of being a terrorist organization. That's different.
Yeah, very briefly, because it would require much longer responses, that going back to Bosnia, what happened there is that Bosnia, when the war started in April 1992, did not get any help in arms because everybody believes these are religious Muslim fanatics. As a result, the deal was made with Arab countries to help them with arms. And what you see today is Muslimization of the Muslim majority in the country, of the entire country. So they were not fanatics, or they were not even religious. They were culturally Muslim, so to say. But what you now see is this religion actually revived there. And you see now Bosnia being turned into Muslim Republic, which is really something that we could not have expected.
I think everyone on the stage has lots more to say, but we'll close it there. I'd like you to join me in thanking Avery Gordon, Ramzi Kasim, and Slavenka Drakulic. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. It was great.